Once again, let's begin with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol hamim V'natan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein haTorah. First of all, happy Tu B'Shvat to everybody. Today is Tu B'Shvat. It started last night, and we are celebrating the anniversary of trees. And the anniversary, or the Rosh Hashanah of trees, is the day that we celebrate the marking time for how we count the age of a tree as far as when you can eat the fruit and when fruit can be brought to the temple when the temple stood. So for the first 3 years, we don't eat the fruit of a tree. In the fourth year, it was taken to Yerushalayim, taken to Jerusalem, taken to the temple. And then in the fifth year, then you could eat it. So the question is, well, how do you count those years? So the time is counted from Tu B'Shvat. Hillel and Shammai had a debate about when that new year should be. Shammai said it should be the first of Shvat, and Hillel said the 15th of Shvat. The question is, what were they even talking about? What was it that they were measuring? So what they were measuring was not that all of the fruit would be out, that you would actually see fruit, not even that it would be blossoming, but rather only that the sap would be rising inside the tree. Now, the sap rising inside the tree has got to be one of the most subtle things that could go on, and celebrating sap rising probably makes watching paint dry look like an extreme sport, you know? So it's like, seriously? I mean, if you sat outside, you couldn't see the sap rise. How would you even know it was happening? So that was the debate between Hillel and Shammai. Shammai said it starts on the first of Shvat. Hillel says by the time it's the 15th, for sure the sap is rising. So let's go with the more. So we go with the more sure thing. So that's why we do it. But Shammai's interesting in his perspective is catching it at the very, very first moment that the sap is rising, which is its own lesson. So this idea about sap rising and the beginning of the process of growth for a tree, this holiday of Tu B'Shvat always comes right before Parsha Yitro, where we are going to learn about the giving of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, the giving of Torah to the Jewish people. So we're going to learn about really what the two things have to do with each other. What does that have to do with anything, Tu B'Shvat, with the giving of Torah, and this ideas about growth. So we're going to turn now to Parsha Yitro, and then we will tie this all together. So Parsha Yitro begins on page 394. Thank you. Page 394. This class is taken from a shiur by Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, and it's named after Yitro. And who is Yitro? Moses' father-in-law. However, in addition to being Moses' father-in-law, he is introduced at the very beginning of the Parsha, in verse 1, that it gives him another name first, very much at the beginning. So let's take a look at that. Hazel, would you like to read just verse 1, chapter 18, verse 1 on page 395?
Yitro, the minister of Midian, the father-in-law of Moses, heard everything that God did to Moses and to Israel, his people, that Hashem had taken Israel out of Egypt.
Okay. So he is introduced to us really with two names or two identifiers. What's the first identifier before our father-in-law of Moshe? He was a minister of Midian, and that which was as an idolater. So it's interesting that it talks about him in that way and also as the father-in-law of Moshe, because we know that Yitro had renounced his ministry of the Midianite idols and everything else that he had been associated with. In fact, there's an interesting midrash that says that the reason his daughters were being harassed at the well when Moshe comes and saves them is because his father was on the social and political outs with Midian because he had renounced his belief in the Midianite religion and had turned himself towards God, towards Hashem, and recognizing God, and that didn't go over well in the Midianite community. So that his daughters were being harassed, and then Moshe saves them. So to introduce him as the minister of Midian is a little unusual because it's talking about him from what he used to be, not what he was any longer. So you could say that's kind of the negative description. The positive description is father-in-law of Moshe. Like, everyone wants to be related to the famous person. We always say that even if somebody's having a simcha, we want to kind of attach ourselves. Like, I am the cousin of the florist who did the whatever for the simcha. It's like, I'm related to that person. So being the father-in-law of Moshe is no small thing. And Moshe was certainly recognized as being an incredibly lofty person by everyone. So he has a description that's a little bit negative and one that is very positive. So we'll come back to that about why he's introduced in that way. But he comes specifically, it says he heard everything that God did to Moshe and to Israel, his people, that Hashem had taken Israel out of Egypt. So the question is, what is it he heard? It said that he heard everything, but the commentaries say that he heard three specific things that he was focused on. One was the miracles of the splitting of the sea, which was amazing and miraculous. Not that the 10 plagues weren't, but the splitting of the sea was really a over-the-top experience. He also heard about the war of Amalek. He heard about, after the splitting of the sea, that Amalek had come and attacked the Jewish people. And it doesn't say in the commentary that he heard that the Jewish people won that war. It's just that he heard about the war, that there was a war. And the third thing is that he heard about the giving of Torah at Har Sinai, and that was enough for him to come and check everything out and want to be with Moshe and the Jewish people. So we're going to come back also to that to answer the question of why those three things, because it says he heard everything that God did to Moshe and to Israel, his people, that Hashem had taken Israel out of Egypt. But those three particular things were noteworthy. So this brings Yitro to us and has him looking at the Jewish people and Moshe and wanting to join in. Patricia.
Sorry, so Moshe had gotten there and lived there for a while before he came to before these things happened.
40 years he had lived in Midian.
So when Moshe was there, was he still worshiping idols?
No.
Yes,
he was already done with that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he had already, converted. It said he went through an intellectual process of evaluating all the religions of that time and came to the conclusion that Judaism and Moshe's Torah's way was the correct way. So he said some people who convert come to it from other, there are different avenues, but his was intellectual, and that he was you could say he was one of those spiritual seekers, and so that he had come to that conclusion. Okay, so that's Yitro, and the loftiness of Yitro is such that we have a whole parsha named for him, which is really also a statement to his greatness. So the Jewish people are going to experience the giving of Torah in this parsha, and one of the things we have to also understand is, how did Yitro hear everything that had happened about the Jewish people? Says, how did he hear? Was there, like Facebook, this is what's going on? How did he hear? There was no social media. Says that everyone knew. It wasn't just Yitro heard through the grapevine, that everybody knew what had happened, but that Yitro was the only person who came to join in. Says, if you were planning an event and the whole world had gotten the flyer and only one person came to your event, you would consider that not so successful. But it says it's an interesting idea that everybody heard, the whole world heard, but only Yitro took the next step of actually doing something with what he heard and came to join with the Jewish people. So that is a testament to his greatness, because most people like to be part of are you going to the party? Oh, no, you're not going? Okay, well, I'm not going either. So most people are not, I'm going to do this even if nobody else is doing it kind of a person. Most of us are like, well, if other people are going, I'll go too. And we get kind of on the bandwagon. Yitro was a standalone kind of person who was willing to go even though nobody else was doing it, and I'm sure the people back home probably had a lot to say to him about what he was doing and why. So he is really an amazing person who we take as a real role model. I'm sorry?
Integrity and nonconformist.
Yes, but he's not a nonconformist for nonconformist's sake. Some people are, I'm a nonconformist. You do this, I do that. It's like, that's actually being a conformist. It's like you're oppositional. So that's not really a merit. Being someone who thinks for oneself is something that is meritorious. Janice. Ah, so this is one example, it says, where that there is not a date order in the Torah. It says that the Torah had already been given, and this section about Yitro coming is placed before the giving of Torah, even though it happened afterwards.
Oh.
So there are a couple of places in Torah where it says that there is no date sequence in Torah, and that's because the Torah is not a history book, and some things are put in different order for the sake of what they teach us. So that's one explanation. Another explanation says that he did come before the Torah was given, and that he had heard about the splitting of the sea and Amalek, and that was enough to get him to come, and he wanted to be part of the giving of Torah. But others say, no, the Torah had already been given, and he wanted to join in after that. Okay, so now we're going to take a look at the Torah, the giving of the Torah. There is a very interesting midrash that says, it's actually in next week's portion, next week's parsha of Mishpatim. What's the very famous line when it says that God offered the Torah to the Jewish people, and what did we say? Na'aseh v'nishma. Except guess what? We don't say it here. We say it in next week's parsha. Okay, we say in next week's parsha, we say na'aseh v'nishma. In this week's parsha, we have another answer that's, you could say, just as good as that kind of an answer. So let's take a look at what that answer, what the people say. And hold on one second. I wrote it down. I should just look instead of thinking I'm going to find it. So hold on one second. Say again? Can you? I'm sorry?
Yes.
402. Yes, where are you?
402.8.
Okay, yes, thank you very much. Okay, so then Moshe comes down to the elders and the people and put before them all the words that Hashem had commanded him. Verse 8, the entire people responded together and said, "Everything that Hashem has spoken, we shall do." Moshe brought back the words of the people to Hashem. So they don't say Na'aseh v'nishma. They say all of the words that Hashem has spoken, we will do. Later in next week's parsha, they say Na'aseh v'nishma.
We'll hear next time.
I'm sorry?
We'll hear
next time. Next time when we come back together. Okay, so for this point, it says everything Hashem has spoken, we shall do, and they are ready to accept Torah. How many of you have heard the whole idea that before the Jewish people got Torah, that God went to all of the other nations? Okay, you've heard that. And what's the story? How does it go?
What's in it?
Yeah, what's in it for me is basically the idea. So what's in it for me? So there is a beautiful understanding about that when it says, what is it that mean that God went to everybody and asked them if they wanted the Torah? So it says that when Hashem was at Mount Sinai, and that this is in, hold your little string here, and we're going to turn for a moment to Vezot HaBracha, which is the very last parsha, and we're going to look at chapter 33, verse 2, the very last parsha of the Torah, and we'll get a page in just a moment. 33, verse 2. And we are on the very beginning of that. Okay, you see page 1113. Page 1113. Now this is Moshe speaking to the Jewish people before he dies, and he is reviewing everything that happened to the Jewish people during the 40 years that they were in the desert, in the Midbar. Okay, Janice, would you like to read verses 1 and 2.
Approached with some of the holy myriads. From his right hand, he presented the fiery Torah to them.
Okay. This is the sentence from which we get the idea and understanding that Hashem presented the Torah to all of the nations. Because it says, Hashem came from Sinai, having shown forth to them from Seir, Mount Seir, having appeared from Mount Paran. The question is, what are those places? What does that mean? that he appeared there, and there was a shining, there was a radiance that went all the way, not just at Mount Sinai, but Mount Seir and Mount Paran as well. It's like, what is that? So Mount Seir, does anyone recognize what that is, who that's associated with Mount Seir? Esav. That's Esav's inheritance. It's called Mount Seir. The word Seir is related to the word Sa'ar, meaning hair. Seir. So that it's, and we know that when Esav was born, it said that he was covered with hair. He was of a hairy mantle. I can imagine probably only a mother could love that kind of whatever, however he looked. Okay, so he looked like that. That was Mount Seir. And Paran is, that is a reference to Ishmael. That's a reference because that he was called a para, that he was called a, Ishmael is called a wild man. So Mount Paran was reference to Ishmael. Har Seir, Mount Seir, was a reference to Esav. Those represent the most likely nations to accept the Torah because they were family. They were the ones who were related to Abraham. And if anybody would have been a likely acceptor, it could have been them. So it said that Hashem's radiance went to all of the nations, and that Hashem spoke the offer of giving the Torah so loudly that everyone could hear, and the only ones who accepted it were the Jewish people. That even being said, the way that God presents the Torah to the Jewish people is an attempt to make it palatable to the other nations, hoping that they would accept it.
Now, is Mount Seir and Paran in what is now Jordan?
You are asking the wrong person, I'm sorry to say. If you're talking history or geography,
yeah. I'm not sure they know.
I think they do, but I don't. We'll have to look that up. Okay.
Can you say that one more time?
Okay.
In terms of making it palatable.
Making it palatable? Okay, so we're going to talk about what that means. What does it mean to make it palatable?
No, can you go back to what you just said?
Ah.
So this is Hashem's idea to make it palatable to the rest of the world.
Yes. And we're going to see that in the giving of the Torah, when we all stand up on Shabbos this week and we hear the Ten Commandments, these Ten Commandments were the commandments that were issued forth as an offer to all of humanity to hear and an invitation to join in. And this is an amazing, it never even occurred to me. Why do we know that this is something different? We're going to actually go through and look at it. This is not the only account of the Ten Commandments. There is another account of the Ten Commandments in Parsha V'Etchanan. In Parsha V'Etchanan, the commandments are different. And if you're going to offer a contract to someone and then you're going to reiterate the contract, you start changing the words in the contract, that's a different deal. So why is there a difference in the commandments? What is the difference? And that's what we're going to talk about today, is like, what was going on? God is issuing a call, a clarion call, to all of humanity to accept the Torah. He's going to make that offer an offer that everybody could accept if they wanted to, that they were not going to give them any reasons to not accept it. The offer that's going to be given to the Jewish people is after the other nations are like, we don't want even that. We don't even want the simpler idea of the Torah. We don't want any of it. So then God says, okay, then Jewish people, I'm going to give you the upgraded version of the more detailed, more intense, loftier Torah that is reiterated in V'Etchanan. There are two different agreements here. But one is the one that's palatable, and one is the one that is what's like, if you could make your dream come true agreement, this is what you would do. So let's take a look at them. So what we want to do now is we want to look at V'Etchanan, and we're going to kind of go a little bit back and forth. So we want to be on page 407, so keep that as one page. And then we also want to be in Parsha V'Etchanan, and we want to be at page, and we're not going to go through all of them because you'll get the idea. You'll see it, how it works. Okay, you want to go to page 969. So 969 and 407. So you can hold those together because we're going to go back and forth. So the first question is, why would God make an offer to the nations that was more lenient that was more palatable to begin with. If you want people to do something, quote, the right way, then why don't you just tell them, this is what I want? Why would you even have the concept of a palatable, more kind of introversion, not introverted, introductory version of the Torah? Why would you do that?
It's a little bit like parents and children.
Uh-huh.
So come here, now sit down, now read the book, you know, like little by little so that you can, it's an easy yes.
Exactly.
Is it an easy yes, or is it that it's, they can only do certain things at one time? Like, kids can't, you can't say, come in, do the laundry, or come to the dishwasher.
It's both. It makes it an easy yes because it's doable. So if someone doesn't have the ability yet, they're not at that level. Telling them what your ultimate expectation is at the very beginning is so completely counterproductive that there's no point to it. In fact, it'll make the person run away and be farther away than when they started. So if you can offer somebody something, an intro, just come hither, you know, just come in and sit down, let's have a snack. Did you have any homework from school today? Well, let's just take it out. Oh, I have so much homework. Well, let's just look at what the assignment is, okay? And then just break it down into the most smallest of small efforts. It's like, then someone can progress. So it's an easy yes because it is doable. And to know where someone is at, and that is true in anything that you want someone to do, even and especially ourselves. So how does growth happen? Little by little by little. Like the sap rising in the tree. You don't say to a tree in the dead of winter, where's your fruit? It's like, I didn't even start yet. Can we just get the sap rising just a little bit? Oh, you're doing such a nice, your sap is rising, and pretty soon it's going to go out to the leaves, and you go slowly, slowly, slowly in steps that are imperceptible, practically. Like you can hardly even see them. This is what God knows we are because God created us. So God's ultimate goal is not, well, I'm going to offer them something just so I can punish them for not taking it. God's goal was, I want to give you something that I think you can do. The fact that they said no is not so great, but it's like, okay. So now we'll go on with the advanced group, which is the Jewish people who are ready for more, and then we get a different set that's slight variation. But let's take a look at it and see how you can see that the first set is more for popular consumption and the second set is more for the Jewish people. So it starts at the very, very beginning. Susan?
Were the Noahide laws even earlier?
Yes. Yes. The Noahide laws were already back in operation after Noah. Even the simpler version. I believe that they were. I think that was, they were basically accepted. There were some, you know, hiccups along the way, as there still are. But I think that that was generally civilization, as it unfolds, starts to look more similar to that a little bit. It's always a challenge. Okay, so here's the Torah. So if we start just on page 407, hold on one second. We are going to take a look at. Actually, I take that back. We're actually going to look at the commandment of Shabbos on page 411. Okay. The commandment of Shabbos. Let's take a look at that. We're going to look at verse 11. About this is the reason given of why we are commanded to observe Shabbos. And Gabi, can you read that in the English for us for in the 6 days?
For in 6 days Hashem made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore Hashem blessed the Shabbat day and sanctified it.
Okay, great. That sounds a little familiar. Where does that sound like it came from? Yes, Kiddush also. And? Breishit. Okay, so Breishit was for all of humanity, right? The celebration of Shabbos, because it is a remembrance of creation, that's for everybody. Okay, that is for everyone. Every human being has a reason to be involved with Shabbos because that was part of the deal of creation. Now flip over to page 969. Actually, why don't you go to page 971. Verse 15. So, Susan, do you want to read that verse 15 on page 971?
And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Hashem your God has taken you out from there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, Hashem your God has commanded you to make the Sabbath day.
Okay. Who is God talking to?
Israel.
The Jewish people. If God would have said that from the get-go, anybody who was not Jewish listening to that would say, oh, that he doesn't mean me. He must mean somebody else. So this was presented in the way that the first one was given in a way so that people could identify, oh, this is about creation. God created the universe, the world. I'm part of that. This is speaking to me. It could be speaking to me. After the non-Jews don't even accept it at all, then God says, okay, what this is really going to be about, really? It's about both, and we have both in our Kiddush. We talk about Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, and 6 days God created the earth as well. So we have both ideas. So we have a dual purpose. It's not that we don't have the first, it's just we have the first and the second. Also, just going back to Shabbos, go back to Parshat Yitro this week on page 411, and what does it say about Shabbos that we should do? So what's the first word in verse 8? Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. That's zachor. That word zachor, remember it, has to do with all the things that we associate with what are called the positive things about Shabbos. Making kiddush, lighting candles, having a nice meal, having a celebratory time. All the, what people call the fun part of it. The fun part of Shabbos. That's the zachor. So if you want people to buy into an aspect of Shabbos and have some celebration of it, what are you going to tell them about? You're going to have your china and your silver and candles and flowers and a kugel and your favorite dessert. It's like, what's not to like? How can you not buy into that? That's wonderful. So, but they didn't want that. Okay, so they didn't want that. And the truth is, for ourselves, when we're growing, and if Shabbos hasn't been a part of our life, where do we start ourselves with our observance and bringing in Shabbos to ourselves?
Challah.
Candles. I started with a potato kugel and mandarin oranges. You know, we start with something small that's fun. It's not, you don't start with, well, don't do this and don't do that, because that doesn't really win so many people who want to participate. That's for the advanced version. And the advanced version we get in V'et Hanan, where we have, on page 969, the first word in verse 12. And what is that? Safeguard, which is the word shamor. The shamor, someone who is shomer Shabbos, someone who is shomer Shabbos is someone who observes all of the boundaries and the restrictions, which on first look like this is a part you wouldn't want, or if you would have as a reason why you wouldn't want to sign up for the whole thing. It's only after you're in it where you find out that those are actually, in a way, even more precious than the Zachor one. But you can't tell somebody that at the outset. That's something you grow into step by step by step. So the Jewish people are given both Zachor and Shamor. It's actually given as a reason, one of the reasons why we are given an extra neshama on Shabbos is so that we can do both aspects, that we can do the Shamor and the Zachor. Lynn, did you have a question?
I do. So from here, from these words, where do all the Shabbos laws come from?
The Shamor ones? They all come, it's all based on the 39, what are called Avot Melacha, the 39 categories of work, of creative labor that were done to build the Mishkan.
But as interpreted by the rabbis?
No, from Moshe. Because right in the Torah it says, Kol melechet avodah lo ta'asu. All forms of creative labor you shall not do.
Okay.
So if you're Moshe on Har Sinai, you have a question right that day. What's your question?
What's creative labor?
What's creative labor? It's like, glad you asked. I'll tell you. These 39. So the 39 are drawn from the Torah, but this is the written Torah.
Right.
The oral law, but our understanding, it has to be. The oral law was given simultaneously, because otherwise you would have no idea what to do with this. If you say, if there's a command, and we're not going to talk about it because we're not looking for death and destruction here, but if you say anyone who does malacha on Shabbos is culpable for a capital offense, you'd want to know what you shouldn't be doing. You can't wait for the rabbis thousands of years later to come up with an idea about it. You got to know right then. So So it was right away given. So that's what Moshe taught. During the 40 years, the Jewish people learned all of the laws. In fact, when Yitro comes to criticize Moshe for how much time he is spending with all the people, part of it is judging them in their cases of adjudicating between issues between one person and another, but part of it is teaching them the law, of explaining all of the details. So that's what they spent 40 years learning, were all of those details. So it's all in there. And there's a great book. There's one that's the rabbi, it's Rabbi Chait, C-H-A-I-T. It's kind of like in a cartoon form, and it has all 39 Avot Malacha, the 39 categories, and and what's derived from them. Because the derivation is important too, because just because I'm not, cutting a hide into whatever, it's cutting something to shape, whether it's a hide or a piece of paper or anything else. So it's what's the essence of the creative act. And so that's all brought down, so we know all of that. So good question. So that's the Shamor Shabbat part, and that's the part that belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. So God tries to bring in the other people on the Zohar, like come for a party like once a week. Let's celebrate. And they're like, I think I have something else to do. Go play golf or do something else. So they didn't really want to have a part of that. Also, another example of something that's a little bit different here is the description about coveting. On page 413, there's actually 9 differences in the text. Just so you know, there's 9 differences between the Yitro text and the V'yatchanan text, and they all follow the exact same principle. So we're just going to cover these several here. So on page 413, verse 14, let's see what that says. Ronnie, would you like to read that?
You shall not covet your fellow's house. You shall not covet your fellow's wife, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, nor anything that belongs to your fellow.
Okay. So what's that a prohibition against? Coveting, right? Coveting. The Hebrew word there, the word is lo tachmod. Okay, you shall not covet. So the question is, what's the definition for this halacha, for the average person of what God is asking for just as a beginner? When would you be in violation of coveting for this? Okay, so the thoughts don't violate this one.
Okay.
Acting on it, like doing something to say like, oh, I see his wife, I think I'll just have a little conversation with her, like, picking out vegetables at King Supers, and we'll just see where it goes from there. So like, as soon as you start to act on it, that's called lo tachmod. That's what you cannot do. So that's a violation. That's for average people. It's like, well, that you could do that. I mean, that's doable. However, for the Jewish people, we have an even more elevated that goes to the realm of thought. So if you turn to V'yatchanan, and we go to the last commandment there, it says, verse 18 on page 971, we have a duality here in that. Valerie, would you like to read on page 971, verse 18?
And you shall not covet your fellow's wife. You shall not desire your fellow's house, his field, his slave, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that belongs to your fellow.
Okay, what got added into not only not coveting?
Desire.
So where does desire reign? Where is that in us? That's internal. How does anyone know what I'm desiring? You can't see that. So lo tachmod, I can tell if you're starting to do something to act on the coveting and on the jealousy. But the taiva, to have a desire for something, that's, as I think we had a famous president said, he only lusted in his heart. So like, I'm off the hook. Okay, so the truth is, a non-Jew is off the hook for only lusting in their heart. A Jew is not. Okay, so we have a deeper sense of what it is we are supposed to strive for, which is that we're not even supposed to have the thought. We are not supposed to have the lustful thought. That's what we aspire to. That doesn't mean we got there all of a sudden or in one fell swoop, but that's our goal, is that we are supposed to control our thoughts, because if we are lusting after somebody else's something, it means that we have a warped perception about how God runs the world and how God runs our life. And that is the problem. Because we only tend to lust after something that we think is within our grasp. You know, the person sitting at home watching the Miss America pageant is not lusting to be, you know, the winner of that, because they're not even in the contest. The runner-up, however, when she says how happy she is for the winner, I'm just guessing that that's not a sincere statement, so that she is lusting for really that I should have been, could have been, and want to be the person who is the winner. Even if she doesn't do anything violent, like, you know, push her off the stage, that would be lo tachmod. But if she can be in her heart, it's actually okay. So, but not for a Jewish person. We are supposed to control that saying. It's not even in my realm. And what's interesting here is another thing got added into the list of what you can't lust after and what you can't do anything about is, in addition to where it says just anything that belongs to your fellow, what got added in was his field. There was no field in the first list. You say, like, well, what's the difference? So somebody's field. You can't really pick up somebody's field and take it. Okay, you can move boundaries or something, but that's a whole other violation. You can't, like, pick up someone's field. Someone's wife or someone's house, you can do something to try to take that. But someone's field, it's just kind of there. So it seems like it doesn't even have any reality around it. It's like, what does it mean, like, I lusted after your field and I wanted to take it, I coveted it? It's like, I can't really do so much about it. It's like, even something you couldn't really, really do something about is still out of the picture. Okay.
But in today's thinking, wouldn't a field be more like a career if I'm lusting after your career? Or
no. We're talking about real estate. We're talking about dirt. Okay. Yeah. The other thing, yes, the word sadeh is so, okay. it's actual field value.
Jezebel lusted after, I can't remember his name, the guy's field. And she had people speak ill of him, lashon hara, and then she had him killed. So
that she could take it. That's true. Good point. But she couldn't go out in the middle of the night and just roll up that field and take it with her. So it becomes, it has a slightly different understanding. But you're right. There's always things you can do to ruin somebody and ruin someone. But when we do talk about it, everything that belongs to your fellow does have to do with their career, their reputation, and you're jealous of somebody's reputation, so you do something to lower it so that your reputation will supersede theirs, or they won't get the job or whatever. That would be the same thing. But that would be acting on it. That's the lo tachmod. If I'm just sitting in my office wishing and thinking that I should have what they have, for a non-Jew, the first version of Torah, that would not have been a violation. For the Jewish person, the deeper Torah, that is, because that's what God really, really, really wants. So these are just several ideas of the differences in the Torah that God presented to all of humanity, hoping that they would buy into it, and then to the Jewish people when they didn't. Because I always wondered, like, why is there a difference? When people say, oh, different people, well, first of all, the ridiculous statement when people say, well, different people edited the Torah. I mean, you don't have to be an editing wizard to recognize that you have two different statements for your Ten Commandments. Okay, that you would have noticed that pretty much right off if you were going to make any kind of corrections. So we have these two different versions, and it answers the question of why. Patricia.
So in both versions, the first commandment mentions who took you out of Egypt.
Ah, so if you notice that in secular listings of the Ten Commandments, where do they start, the Ten Commandments?
They actually, it's interesting, they combine our first two into their one. So it says, I am the Lord your God, no false idols. And those are two for us. And then, the do not covet for the tenth, they make 9 and 10, do not cover your neighbor's wife, do not cover your neighbor's property.
Okay, so they make it different.
So they took it out, yeah.
So there is an idea that first commandment is not a commandment.
Oh, it's more of a statement.
It is a statement. This is just an opening statement. This is going back to Parsha Yitro on page 407. God spoke all these statements saying, I am Hashem your God who is taking you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. That's a preface. That's like, this is why we're having the conversation. So I don't want to overstate that this was all of humanity and rule out the fact that God was speaking to the Jewish people. Since God was primarily speaking to the Jewish people, but if you could understand it as loud enough so that the other nations could eavesdrop and hear it, so that if they wanted to be part of it, they could. So it's not about the Jewish people, but it has a wider, they're looking to, he's casting the net much wider to invite all of humanity to join in, and that they were not willing to even with that. So then the Jewish people become the receivers of the Torah. Interestingly, though, there is a recommendation in the Code of Jewish Law that we recite the Ten Commandments every day. And why would we do this? This is, we're supposed to do this to help us on our spiritual path, to recognize that God gave us commandments for the purpose of spiritual growth. Even the fact that there are Ten Commandments and not one was to convey to us that spiritual growth is a step-by-step process. So back when we said that the Jewish people said in next week's Parsha, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen, the Midrash says, for because the Jewish people said that, that God decided that it was worthy of him to reveal to the Jewish people what he created every day of creation. It's like, I thought we already knew what God created for every day of creation. The merit of the Jewish people saying, Na'aseh v'nishma, made it worthwhile for God to say, I will tell them, I will reveal to them what I created each day of creation. So what does that mean? When they said Na'aseh v'nishma, here's another understanding of that. Na'aseh v'nishma is usually translated, we will do and we will listen. Meaning we'll do it first and then we'll hear about it after. But there's another way that that can be read, and this is not a newfangled way of reading it. There's another way of reading it that says, Na'aseh ma'sha nishma. We will do what we can hear. We will do what we are ready to do. We will do what we are at the level to take on, and if we can't hear it yet, we are not taking it on. Meaning, I'm going to go do this step-by-step process, and I'm not going to take the whole thing on. So God's saying like, ah, you got it. That's the key to spiritual growth, is little by little by little. Don't say, oh yes, I'm taking everything on, because that's a sure sign for a big fall. How do we know it's a sure sign for a big fall? This goes back to what Yitro said when he came to see the Jewish people, that he heard about the splitting of the sea, and then he also heard about the war of Amalek. At the splitting of the sea, the commentary says the Jewish people, that the lowliest servant had a level of prophecy that was greater than Ezekiel, who's the most out there prophet. That the lowest person, the most simple person, had the greatest level of prophecy, and the Jewish people were so aware of God's presence that they said, Zeke Levion Vehu, this is my God and I will glorify him. It was like almost like tangible, their reality and of God's presence in their life. They went from that to the end of the Parsha. So just skip back a moment to the end of Parsha Bishalach before they had the war with Amalek. And let's see what happens. We're talking about the same Parsha, the very same Parsha that had the splitting of the sea. If you turn to page 391, the Jewish people are complaining, which that's already kind of something that's going on, but their complaining takes on a different, whole other level in verse 7 on the bottom of page 391. So, Lynn, would you like to read that for us?
Called the place Massa in Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because of their test of Hashem, saying, is Hashem among us or not?
Okay. You go from Ze Levion Vehu to, is there a God in this world? Is he with us or not? Seriously, this is what happened? And then it says Amalek came and battled Israel. Amalek only comes when there's that level of lack of trust. And Yitro heard this. It's like, they went from the level of the splitting of the sea to asking, is God with me or not, with us or not? How is that possible? It says, that is exactly what's possible. the splitting of the sea, that level of prophecy that the Jewish people reached, and you could say in a way they overreached. They reached a level that was not sustainable because it didn't represent any work on their part for having gotten there. Because we know, what do we say when the Jewish people left Egypt? What level of spiritual impurity were they at? 49th level in the basement. And then they're at this top level saying, Zeh Levion Behu. This is like a person who jumps from the bottom rung of a ladder to the top rung of the ladder. What's the most likely thing that's going to happen when they're up there? Fall off. Because they didn't actually climb. They jumped. Now, it's no fault of their own. God created a reality that made them jump. But then God is saying, that's not really how we're going to do things here. That's not really real spiritual growth. That was a spiritual moment. That did not reflect spiritual growth. So oftentimes, we, in our effort to have spiritual growth, think we want a splitting of the sea moment. And we say, if God would just only do something amazing, I would be so on board in a minute. I would just sign up. It's like, you'd sign up and you'd sign right off. Because as soon as that event was over, something would happen that would take us back down to our original level and we would be probably in a worse position than we were before. Because this level of Amalek coming, that's almost like the 50th level. That means that the Jewish people bottomed out completely. Yitro hears this and he's thinking like, wow, maybe I've gone too fast. I was a Kohen Midian. I was not just a follower of the Midianite religion. I was the priest of it. And I've gone from that to now I've accepted Torah, I've accepted God. Maybe I've gone too fast. I better go be with Moshe and the Jewish people to receive the Torah, because the Torah is the path for how to take it slowly. Because God says, I'm trying to tell you, I want you to go slowly. This is what I want, but I want you to go slowly, step by step. When we talk about doing something step by step, we often use the term ekev, which means the heel. It has always to do with the mitzvot, it says that people step on, like the little things. I'm going just heel by heel. Did you ever see how far and fast you can walk if you walk on your heels? Not so fast, okay? So if you just go heel by heel by heel, slowly, 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 it says, I want an ekev approach. That's what the Torah is really about. That's what spiritual growth is really about. And we have two beautiful references to this. So going back now to our Parshat Yitro, and the giving of Torah, one of the references has to do with something that doesn't seem like it would refer to things going slowly. It seems like it would be more dramatic. On page 405, verse 16. And Peggy, would you like to read that for us, verse 16?
On the third day when it was morning, there was thunder and lightning and a heavy cloud on the mountain. The sound of the shofar was very powerful.
Okay. This is a pretty dramatic moment as moments go. If you were going to be convinced of something, it helps to have a light and sound show like this and have all of this going on. And yet, there is a hint in the words that describe the awesomeness of it that actually tell us how we're supposed to experience our growth, our spiritual growth. And let's take a look at that. So when it says there was thunder and lightning and a heavy cloud, so the Hebrew word for lightning, I'm sorry, the Hebrew word for thunder is kolot, is one of the words from the word kol, like a very loud sound. And the word for thunder, for lightning is barak, like Ehud Barak. And the word for a cloud is anan. So what was there? There was thunder, lightning, and a cloud. If you take the first letter of each of those words, the first letter of the word kolot is a kuf. The first letter of the word barak is a bet. And the first letter of the word anan is an ayin. Those letters spell the word ekev, which means heal. It says, it may look like we're having this event that has all of this drama, but don't have your spiritual life be this dramatic change where you go from one thing to another overnight. It's not going to work. I want you to go ekev. It's in the form, the presentation is in the form of an anan, of an ayin, of kolot, of thunder, and of barak, of lightning. But I want your process to go slowly. Even more so, if we take all of the words that make up the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, and you count those up, It has a numerical equivalent that's the same as Ekev. It's the exact same. It's like, it's about Ekev. It's about your heel. It's about going slowly. Even though we're having this big light and sound show, your process from this day on, you cannot live. You are not going to be able to hold in your mind the experience that you're having here today at Har Sinai. You only take a little piece and grab it and go day by day, slowly, 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 very, very slowly. So all of that is hinted to in the actual structure of the Ten Commandments, as well as the what happened in the giving of Ten Commandments. There's another piece that also hints at it to us for us, and that is at the very end of the Parsha, on page 415. Verses 21 through 23, and let's take a look at that. Paula, would you like to read that for Paula?
An altar of earth shall you make for me, and you shall slaughter near your elevation offerings, and your peace offerings, your flock and your herd. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. And when you make for me an altar of stones, do not build them hewn, for you will have raised your sword over it and desecrated it. You shall not ascend my altar on steps so that your nakedness will not be uncovered.
Great. So two things. This commandment about building an altar does not belong in this Parsha. It belongs in Parsha Truma, which is all of the description of everything that was built for the Mishkan. So what is it doing here in any case? And then it says it's supposed to be an altar of earth. Okay, an altar of earth, a mizbach adama. So why an altar of earth? It says because we are Adam. We are human beings. We are physical. We are earthy. And we need to recognize that that's our nature and not have an illusion of grandeur that's inappropriate that will actually take us down. However, we are also lofty, which is an altar has to do with elevating something. Everything that goes on an altar is something that's elevated. So we elevate ourselves, but God gives us a very specific commandment that says, the last verse, you shall not ascend my altar on steps. You cannot go on steps. You have to go on a ramp. Okay? No steps. And it says, so that your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it. But what nakedness? Okay, the Kohanim wore robes. So it says, you know, that the steps could have seen as if they were animate, that they could see under the robes of the Kohanim. And if you're taking big steps, up steps, so then you're kind of exposed. But the Kohanim, it wasn't like they had nothing on underneath. They wore pants. They had like pantaloons underneath that. So there was no nakedness of that kind that was exposed. It says, there's another nakedness. It says, if there were steps, when you see young people or people who have good knees, when they see steps and they are enthusiastic about getting someplace, what do? They jump. Okay, they jump steps. They take two steps at a time. That's how they show you like how spry they are, enthusiastic, whatever. A ramp doesn't really present that opportunity to us in the same way. A ramp is more a place, which is why they have it for people who are handicapped in some ways, because a ramp is easier to get up and it gives you a more gradual incline. Whereas the steps take you too fast and you might overstep. And what is the nakedness? The nakedness is you're going to fall. You're going to fall and then you're going to expose your vulnerability, so don't do that. I want you earthly people, human beings who I created so lovingly, who have the potential to ascend tremendous heights, but you need to go on an altar of earth and it needs to be a ramp. And not steps that you're going to just go bounding up too quickly, because my goal is for you to ascend to the greatest heights. So the giving of Torah is for that.
Gradually.
I'm sorry?
Gradually.
Gradually, slowly, slowly, Ekev.
I have a question. I'm visualizing this. It says to have unhewn rocks, so I'm guessing it's kind of lumpy and bumpy, which would also slow them down?
That's for the sides of it, not for the...
Also, the ramp is dirt.
The dirt to go up. The ramp. That's actually not a good answer, but I need to answer some other questions. I want to share something else so that we conclude. Peggy?
I realize this is a step for spirituality.
Yes.
But isn't this a metaphor for life as well? We've got to learn the basics of everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. So we use this for everything. If someone takes you too fast, in fact, when you hear people say, oh, they shoved it down my throat, anytime someone describes their Jewish life like that, Most people, what that means is they gave it to me. I wasn't ready to hear what they said to me, and so it was a very unpleasant negative experience. Maybe wanted to, you know, throw it back up, which is what will happen. So that we are eating. I mean, even when we talk about Torah, we say a devar Torah, a word of Torah, just a little bit at a time. It said Moshe was the masterful teacher, that he was able to teach each person what they could hear at the time. You know the joke that you ask someone what time it is and they tell you how to make a watch? You know, it's like, I just wanted to know what time it was. So that masterful teacher knows what is your question, what are you really ready to hear, so that I can tell you that much, so that it can go in and can sit and digest and become a part of us. So when God tells the Jewish people, because you said na'aseh ma'asheh nishma, we will do what we are prepared to hear, and you recognize that everything is meant to be done in stages, now you understand that that's even the way I created the world. People argue, science, was it 6 days? Was it 6 billion years? The question is, if it's God, it could have been in an instant. Why even have the Torah's description that there were 6 days? Why have any days? Just say God created everything and there it was. You don't really have to have anything laid out in any separate kind of day situation. So that's what I'm trying to tell you. So I will reveal to you that the reason I created the world in segments, step by step, is because that is the way of life, that's the way of spiritual growth, and that each day has something special that we're supposed to focus on. So that's what I want to conclude with, is what each day is for. Because we have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Shabbos. So what are we supposed to do on each of those days? Because that's given to us as well. So first of all, we know that one of the commandments of keeping Shabbos is, it says, 6 days you shall work, and the seventh day is the Sabbath. So the question is, what if I am independently wealthy and I don't need to work? So does that, what are you telling me, I have to go to work? So we're not talking about 6 days you shall go to work at your job. It's six, which you may have to do that also. 6 days you have work, spiritual work to do, and on the seventh day you will be in a place then to reap the benefit of the work that you put in, and you will be able to ascend to a new and higher level. So then the question is, what's the work? So let's talk about it. So the work on Sunday, every day, every Sunday, is Sundays are designed for us to take one step, one spiritual step, either a part of a mitzvah, a part of a spiritual quality, and to do it totally, to not do it in a half-baked way. So let's, whatever it might be. So let's say it is, you're going to work on the mitzvah of lighting Shabbos candles, and you're going to make sure that your candlesticks have candles and that they're polished and ready to go. That's what I'm doing on Sunday. I'm going to make sure on Sunday that I'm ready to go for Shabbos. I'm getting ready for that. It doesn't have to be Shabbos related. It could be anything. It could be tzedakah. It can be anything. Any little tiny mitzvah, to take one small part, but to do it 100% and not flake out at the end. It says, why is that? It says that on Sunday, that was the creation of day and night, and it was extreme. It was, the part that was light was completely light. The part that was dark was completely dark. It wasn't blended together. So doing something 100%, it was also called Yom Echad, which means a day of unity and oneness, not a day of, kind of neither here nor there. So Sunday is about unity, which is kind of interesting, because in our culture, it's very hard, because Sunday for me is kind of the ketchup, lounge around a little bit more kind of day. So, but this is saying, no, do something really in a small way but significant. Monday is designed to work on anger, and also in a small way. So let's say there's, pick one thing that kind of, you can feel your blood rising a little bit and you get a little bit angry for some situation, be it a person, a situation, whatever, that's the time to work on anger. Why? It says because on that day, the lower waters were separated from the upper waters in creation, and the lower waters were angry that they were farther away from Hashem. So it says on that day, we're supposed to deal with our quality of anger. So that's the work for Monday. The work on Tuesday is that we're supposed to withhold ourselves from forms of immorality or things that are inappropriate for us to really be involved with, whether it has to be looking at things, listening to things, things that kind of titillate our senses, anything like that that take us on the cultivating desires, things that are immoral, we're supposed to stay away from on Tuesday. So that's the work of Tuesday. So that's not the day to read the article in whatever magazine you might have on your table. So save it for a different day. On Wednesday, it says we're supposed to serve Hashem with our intellect. We're supposed to do something that has to do with thinking and using our mind and learning something new. So it can be one thing. It can take 10 seconds. It doesn't have to be anything like I learned the entire Parsha. It can be one small thing. But Wednesday is the day for using our minds in an intellectual way. Thursday is the day we're supposed to focus on Chesed. So that was the day that God created all the fish and all the different kinds of birds and all of the varieties, which required so many different kinds of food for all of them. And it's a tremendous act of Chesed that God can provide everything that everybody needs. That's really an incredible miracle. So that on Thursdays, we're supposed to be like God and work on providing for other people in doing one act of Chesed with some kavana, doing something for somebody else as a favor, an act of kindness, and that's our Thursday avoda. That is our Thursday work. Friday is for longing for mitzvot, that we're supposed to long and cultivate in ourselves a desire to have the mitzvot help us in our journey of spiritual growth. It says, how do you cultivate? It's like, how do you long to create a longing? It's a little bit strange. It says, read something inspirational, to read something about spiritual growth that makes us want it. As an Erev Shabbos, there's an idea that somebody who's born on a Friday says that they will have a longing for mitzvot, that it's as if they push their way out of their mother in time to get out to have Shabbos. So it's like, means you're eager and enthusiastic. So whatever it might take to create a longing. And then on Shabbos, it says, we're ready to cross the portal. We're ready to cross into the next level that we have achieved, and that that's our time of not just rest, like, oh, I'm done with all that work, but now I can enjoy the fruits of my labor each and every day. So we don't have undifferentiated time. We say every day, one day is just like another, and we don't have all the work is to be done on one day. We don't have either one. We have pick a little something and vary it. It reminds me of when people advocate about how to do exercise. They don't just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, like change it up, use different muscles. So the muscle, your chesed muscle, is a different muscle than your emotion of anger, which is a different muscle than your intellect, which is a different muscle than generating enthusiasm. All of those things are different aspects of ourselves, since that's the work that we're supposed to do. So that the 6 days that we're commanded to work are not just there as a counterpoint to the seventh day of rest, they're there as a command also. That 6 days we are supposed to work on ourselves and work very slowly in an ekev manner, as manifested in the Ten Commandments. And it's that version of the Ten Commandments that we read every day. We don't read the one quote for the Jewish people. We read the basic Ten Commandments, because all of us in some way are reluctant spiritual growers. And we all need the opportunity to be reminded that we're talking about a very slow, slow, gradual process that will take us to tremendous heights, and that we can then ascend on an altar and can sanctify ourselves and become the kind of people and that created in the image of God that God is looking for. The holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which, as I said, celebrates the rising sap, and again, I can't imagine what more subtle of a celebration one could have than that, is perfectly matches the idea of what we're talking about in this week's Parsha of accepting the Torah. It's like, yes, na'aseh, but na'aseh ma'sha nishma. We accept upon ourselves that which we can hear, which we are prepared to hear right now. And God says, you've got it. That's what I want from all of you and from all of, ultimately all of humanity. So God willing, when we stand in our shuls this Shabbos and hear these Ten Commands, we'll know that God is talking to all of us, and certainly each one of us, encouraging us and inspiring us, hopefully, to move forward in our spiritual progress little by little. Have a wonderful rest of your Tu B'Shvat and a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you. I'm going to Israel if anybody wants to put something
in. Oh, I'm not sure this went all the way around.
Oh.
So here's the envelope.
Did it just stop right there?
No, it went all the way in back.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.